I was reading over the notes on the development of Solomon and Israel.
Yes.
And I wondered if you would mind quickly drawing a picture of how David started with Heman to do and Ethan, and who was under them and who was under their sons and how it all. Because I couldn't quite follow how you got all the numbers again.
Oh, you can't figure out how to get the numbers?
I just start with, David, right. 1-3, and just let me see it.
Okay.
Put it
got Heman. He was son of Asaph to the right.
Okay.
Ethan to the left. Now, Heman had 14 sons.
Okay.
All right. Now each one had 11 brethren. So you have 14 groups of 12. Now you see 14 sons, 11 brethren with each son. Now 11 and 1 makes 12. You with me?
11. Oh, and the son.
All right. Like for each son, you have 11 brethren. So you have 14 groups of 12. You with me so far?
Yes.
Okay. Now, that would give you a total of 168 skilled musicians. You with me so far, Tom?
Okay.
All right. Now, the same thing would be over here. Asaph had 4 sons.
So, 11 with each.
11 with each one. That would give you 48. Ethan had 6 sons. 11 with each one. That would give you 72 skilled musicians. Now, there are all of your skilled musicians. That would be 288.
Who are these brethren? Sons of them?
No. No. See, and we can't be sure whether the word sons, Jack, means physical sons or is just talking about musical family. See, now the brethren are simply Levites, that's all. And you will remember that we saw that they had 288 skilled musicians. And these are the 288 skilled musicians. Then you will remember that we had, what this means then is, looking back here, you have 14 choirs of 12 each that would perform. You see, here, 4 choirs. 4 choirs of 12 each that would perform. And the same thing over here with 6 choirs of 12 each. And remember that list that we had at the end of 1 Chronicles 25? That was the order in which they were to perform, the 12 choirs. I mean, the 24 choirs altogether, because 1464 give you 24. You see how it goes so far?
Yes.
All right, now, how many Levites were set aside for the ministry of music altogether?
4,000.
Now, you had 4,000 set aside altogether. 288 would be skilled musicians. That would leave 3,712 trainees. And now, most people believe that the 3,712 trainees were divided up among the 24 choirs, which would give you roughly about 155 trainees in each choir.
Okay. But they wouldn't sing with the choir.
Not until they were sufficiently trained.
But wouldn't you get them all trained eventually?
Well, now how that worked, Tom, we can only guess because it doesn't say.
So they just that, replace the person when they die or retire?
Well, it could be that sometimes, like when they were sufficiently trained, they would give each other a break because, see, they would be performing periodically. And
would be that Eric Green was sufficiently trained that instead of having the originals, well, this is guesswork because it doesn't say, instead of having the original 12, maybe one of the sons would take and replace some of them with some of the trainees. We just don't know how that worked. But this much we do know, and that there were 155 trainees with each form. That would be the logical conclusion, because in 1 Chronicles 23, it says that the 4,000 were divided among the three families. So you see, it says that. And so we have to go from there. Now, a little bit is guesswork, but the facts would be what I have given there. So you see how that works?
Okay. Well, then why, on page 15, you have had David appointed Haman and Ethan to minister before the tabernacle of Gideon.
Yes.
And Asaph before the tent.
That's right. That's when David initially established it. Now, later on, apparently, what he did was to have all three of them minister before the tent.
Okay, so at some point he brought the other two back to Jerusalem.
That's right. Now, it doesn't mean anything. They still didn't minister at the tabernacle. But he brought them back to Jerusalem, evidently, to minister there as well. Now, you see, some of those facts, Tom, we can only guess because it doesn't say. You do have the fact that it says that they ministered all three of them before the tent. You do have the fact that David sent some up to Gideon. Now, how do those fit together? There's not going to be a contradiction. When he started it, he had the one group there before the tent, 12 Asaph with 11 others.
And that's where the ark was.
That's where the ark was. And then the others where the tabernacle was. Now, later on, how much later on, I don't know, he had all three ministering before the tent, where the ark was. That's right. And they had their positions there. And of course, when they ministered before the tabernacle, they had their positions. Now, whether or not Asaph ever went to the tabernacle to minister, I don't know, because we just are not told. See, we can go with the facts that we have. But does that help you to see how it is?
Yeah.
So, all right.
Now, see, the formation is the same. Is this description of the formation as well?
The formation?
Right.
Now, what do you mean by the formation?
Well, when they would actually march and play above the ark.
Oh, now that was different. That was only a one-time thing. when they brought the ark up, they had Kenaniah to set up a very elaborate procession, because he knew all the regulations concerning the transportation of the ark. And since he knew that, David was sure that everything would be in order. This time they wouldn't blow it like they did before and incur the judgment of the Lord. But see, that was only the one-time thing when he had Kenaniah set up that procession when they brought the ark from the house of Obed-Edom to Jerusalem. Now, they had a procession before. We're not told the order of it when they brought it from Kirjath-Jearim up. When the Lord judged them, there was some kind of procession then, but we're not told the order of it. But this one, we are.
So in the formation, then of the ordinary worship service, is there anything?
No, there's not that, except when the music was performed. Everybody was staying in their positions. Remember, I emphasized that Heman always had the central position. So any time Heman's group ministered, they would always be in that position. They knew exactly where they would be. Any time Asaph's group ministered, they'd be in that position. Any time Ethan's group ministered, they'd be in that position. And they knew where and when. That's what it means when it says that they stood according to their custom, where they were accustomed to stand in 1 Chronicles 16. According to their custom and according to their order. Their order would be that order that you have in 1 Chronicles 25. So they knew when they were to serve. So they knew where they were to stand and when they were to serve.
Maybe you already said answer this, but did they actually, the choir groups sing together?
At times.
All
at times, on special concerts. And at that particular time, they believe that, now this is speculation, that since Heman occupied the central position, that he would in all probability be the director, leading all of them.
Heman, since he occupied a central position, would in all probability. See, now I can't state that for sure. I mean, that's a conclusion I'm drawing, would in all probability be the correct.
Now, these 288 skilled professions.
Yes.
Were they singers and trumpet players and cymbal players?
Yes.
They were all kinds.
Yeah, they sang and played. They played the psaltery, the harp, the cymbal. They didn't play the trumpets. They had the priests play the trumpets. But psaltery, the harp, and the cymbals were the instruments they played. Remember in 1 Chronicles 25, it said that David set them aside with these instruments to praise the Lord and give thanks. And so, yes, they did play Asaph. Heman and Ephod, you know, they played the cymbals. They are specified as the ones who played the cymbals. And the others played the psaltery and the harp. Remember, we have six psaltery players and three harp players in the original one that was set up when the ark was brought up. And the rest of them were sent to the tabernacle. And they played the psaltery and the harp. Played and sang together, and they were the permissions.
Now, when, say, just Asaph was ministering in the temple, the other two weren't on duty.
Yeah.
Would they still stand off to the right?
Yes, they would stand to the right. They knew exactly where they were standing. And see, that was their position, and they would always occupy the position. Ephod to the left, Asaph to the right, Heman's group at the center. So they knew exactly where they were to minister when. See, David had it so highly organized. And like when these various groups would minister, see, they drew the names out so it would be no advantage of any group. They knew exactly where they were staying, exactly where they were ministering. See, that's how well he had his set up. It's just an amazing picture. Now, most of that, Tom, would be factual. A little bit, as you can see, would be conclusions that I have drawn from that, but I think they're reasonable conclusions in light of what. All right, any other questions on that? I'm sure you see how you get those numbers. And remember the word scholars there in 1 Corinthians chapter 25. See, that refers to students and distinguishes the teachers who would be the proficients from the students. And these scholars would be the other 3,712 that were chosen, set aside by David. From the Levites to minister. Okay, any other questions on that? All right, now, let's come now to the next thing we have today. And this is very fascinating. And this is the matter of the Psalm title. Now, if you understand what we're talking about, when we talk about the Psalm title, we're talking about all of those titles on the individual Psalms. And there are a number of the Psalms that have Psalm titles. There's only 34 orphan Psalms. Now, when we talk about orphan Psalms, what do we mean? Somebody tell me.
They
don't have a title. So that means that you have 116 Psalms with titles. Not all of them have the author. Remember, you only have 102 authors specified. But you have 116 Psalms with Psalm titles. Now, what we want to do is to look at these Psalm titles and glean what information we can concerning them and try to determine what our attitudes toward them should be. Now, I started off by giving you various attitudes toward the Psalm titles. And one attitude is this, that the Psalm titles are not inspired and have no historical value. Now, this is the way some view the Psalm titles, and it's very obvious that they view the Psalm titles this way. Many liberal scholars will just say the Psalm titles are worthless. They are no value, no historical value, no musical value. They're just worthless, and so they just throw them out. One of them, as you would suspect, would be W.O.B. Osterlitz. He just says, point blank, in his commentary on the Psalms, that the Psalms have no historical value. a another group that took the same approach, the same attitude, and that was the translators of the New English Bible. Now, I put in here for you a quotation from a section that comes from the New English Bible. Remember, the New Testament was done first in 1961, and the Old Testament in 1970. And here is a quotation from the section entitled Introduction to the Old Testament. This was written by Professor Godfrey R. Dryling, and he was one of the men who did work on the New English Bible. And he mentions the Psalm titles in this section entitled Introduction to the Old Testament. I just listen to what he says. The hymns of the Psalms, consisting partly of musical instructions, of which the meanings have been mostly lost. So he says now, the Psalm titles partly have musical instructions, and the meanings of those musical instructions have been mostly lost. So we just don't know what a lot of those musical instructions mean. And partly of historical notices. So he says you have historical notices in the Psalm titles, deduced sometimes incorrectly from the individual Psalm. Now what he's saying is that all the historical notices are simply deduced from the individual Psalms. The Psalms were written first, and then they looked to see if they could figure out the historical background, and if they could, they wrote it down. And he says sometimes what they deduced from the Psalm was incorrect. They wrote down the wrong historical background. And so he says that in light of these two things, now watch this closely, they are almost certainly not original. I just underscore that in your mind. You see, they are almost, if they're not quite sure they're not original, but almost certainly not original. And because of that, they have been omitted. So what they do is look at the Psalm titles and they say, well, here we have musical instructions. A lot of the meaning of that, those musical instructions have been lost. We don't know what they mean. They have historical notices that are derived from the Psalms after the Psalms were written. Some of them are incorrect. And so it's obvious from this that they are almost certainly not in the original. And so since they are almost certainly not in the original, they have omitted them. And so if you read the New English Bible, you won't find a single Psalm title in there, because they consider them as worthless. They consider them as of being no value whatsoever. And then they say, on the other hand, the designations of the speaker in the Song of Songs, that's the Song of Solomon, though absent from the Hebrew text, now see, there's no question that these are not in the Hebrew text, though absent from the Hebrew text, have been introduced with the occasional corrections from two manuscripts of the Septuagint. Now, this just kind of blows my mind. Here are the Psalm titles. Now listen to this carefully. They are almost certainly not original. We're not quite sure. So they eliminate them from the Book of Psalms. But here are the designations of the speakers in the Song of Solomon. Now, they are definitely, they are certainly not in the original. No question about that. They are definitely not in the original, and yet they introduced them. Now, can you figure that out? The one is almost certainly not in the original. They eliminate them. And the one that is definitely not in the original, they include them in the Song of Songs. To me, that just makes no sense at all. If something is almost certainly not in the original, as far as they are concerned, and we'll examine that to see whether or not that statement is accurate. But to say that something is almost certainly not in the original, you would think that they would just put a note, well, we feel it's almost certainly not in the original, but we can't be sure, and so we'll leave them in so that you can make your own choice, or at least put a footnote about it. But no reference whatsoever. They have been completely eliminated. And the reason is that they just don't consider them of any musical or historical value. They just eliminated them all together. Tom,
You mean, so if you had a meeting doing the Bible Old Testament, there wouldn't be himself by
this? That's right. Here is the New English Bible right here. Now, if you look at Psalm 3, that's the one that you're doing for your paper, you will notice in your Hebrew Bible you have a Psalm title. So, and I'll just look at Psalm 3 right there. See, now it starts off, Lord, how are my enemies, how my enemies have multiplied, many rise up against me. Just completely eliminated, no reference, no footnote, nothing whatsoever, completely removed. See, there they are. Now, that's the attitude of the New English Bible. And see, the reason they are doing that, and this is the one that Bruce endorsed, the reason they are doing that is because they say that they are almost certainly not original. But see, that they themselves will admit they can't be certain that they're not in the original. But they feel that their attitude is that they're of no historical value, so just eliminate them. What's the sense of putting them in? That they're no historical value. And so they just leave them out completely, not even a footnote. You look down here at the footnotes. You won't see a single footnote stating that that psalm originally had a psalm title. Not a single footnote to indicate. They've got footnotes about Psalm 2 that we discussed. They've got one here from a part in verse 3. Another one, well, that goes in Psalm 4. But no footnote even to indicate that there was a psalm title. They just completely removed. Now, that just shows you the attitude that they have towards psalm titles. You look at that, no psalm title in there. Anyway, all the psalm titles, all 116, completely removed. Why? Because their attitude is they are no historical value. They are certainly not in the manuscripts, in the autographs, so they just eliminate them. And not even a footnote specify that they are found in the Bible. But that's their attitude. Now, that's one attitude that you find. Now, another attitude is this, that the psalm titles are of value, but are not inspired. The psalm titles are of value, but are not inspired. Now, this is the attitude of John Richard Sammy. Now, Sammy wrote an article in the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. It's not the one that you read. You read the revised edition. But in the older edition, he wrote an article on the psalm titles. And in this article, he makes a very interesting point. He says, now, when you look at the psalm titles, it is very clear that the psalm titles are very old. He says there's no question about that. Now, here's why he says the psalm titles are very old. He says, now, the Septuagint translated the psalm title. Question, what date was the Septuagint made? Second century B.C. Now, you know then that since they translated the psalm titles, that they were in existence, at least by that time. You can't translate something that's not in existence. And so, the psalm titles would have been in existence at that particular time. But, he says the evidence shows that they were in existence a long time before that time. Why? Because the Septuagint translators didn't understand many of those psalm titles. Now, when those psalm titles were first written, they would have made perfect sense. Nobody's going to write nonsense and put it on the psalm. So when those psalm titles were first written, they would have made perfect sense. So what you have to do is to allow enough time between the time that those psalm titles were written and the time the Septuagint translation was made for the meaning of some of those musical instructions to be lost so that they wouldn't understand what they meant. And for some of the meanings of the words to be lost, so that they wouldn't know how to translate them. And the Septuagint translators very obviously didn't know how to translate some of psalm title. For example, when you have that phrase, Lamed Haseach, and you've seen that act as overseer to the one who is acting as overseer or superintendent, they translate that as to telos, or the end. Just makes no sense whatsoever. Then here is Mahalanah, and I'll show you this later in Psalm 88 on the Psalm title. Well, they didn't know what that meant. And if you don't know what something means, like the English translators did, what do? You transliterate. See? And then somebody sees that word in English, and they say, well, I never saw that word before. And they look it up, and they still don't know what it means because it's not in Webster's dictionary. It's a transliteration. And that's what you have from the Hebrew into the Greek. Mahalath would be transliterated into Greek letters because they didn't know what it meant. Now, what Sammy is saying is that here were these psalm titles that they were written at a period long enough before the Septuagint translation was made so that the meaning of these musical instructions would be lost, and that some words would lose their meaning so that the Septuagint translators would not know how to interpret them. So you have to set them back prior to the 2nd century B.C. and long enough for that to happen. Now, how long that is a subjective matter, but it has to be a good amount of time. Now, what he says is that the worst you can say about the psalm type, the worst that you can say about it, is that they are guesses of scribes and editors and compilers at a time long before the Septuagint was written. That's the worst that you can say about the psalm titles. And so he says, when you keep that in mind, he says, if you want to say the worst about the psalm titles in light of the evidence, the worst that you can say is that they're simply guesses of editors and scribes and compilers at a time long before the Septuagint was made. But now he says, suppose the worst were true. Suppose these psalm titles were guesses of scribes and editors and compilers at a period long before the Septuagint was made. Should we throw them out? Is that scientific to throw them out? And the answer is no. Why? Now here is the answer. Because even if these psalm titles were guesses of scribes and editors and compilers, either during or after the exile, even if that were true, and Sammy doesn't say that that is true, but even if it were, they were closer to the composition of the psalm than any modern critics today. See the point? They were closer to the composition of the psalm than any modern critics today. And because they were closer to the composition of the psalm than any modern critics today, they had access to sources of information regarding the authorship and date of that psalm, both oral and written, which would have long since perished, and which modern scholars today simply do not have. And for that reason, he says, it's absolutely unscientific to throw them out. He says, it just makes no sense at all. Captivity or after the captivity, even if that were true, because they were closer to the time when the psalm was written and had therefore access to sources of information regarding the authorship and date of those psalms that had long since perished, both oral and written sources concerning the authorship and date of those psalms. Since they had that, we should never throw them out, but we should pay very careful attention to what they say. Now, he says, they are of value because of that reason. It's because of their antiquity, because they are so old, that they are of value. And what we need to do in estimating their value is to apply the best critical processes we have to it and determine by those processes what in that position is accurate and not throw it out. Now, he said, we're not saying that the song titles are always intelligible to us. He said, we're not saying that at all. And he's not saying, we're not saying that the song titles are always accurate. That's what Sandy said, not what I'm saying. What Sandy said, he said, they're not always accurate, but he said, nevertheless, they are of historical value. And because they are of historical value, due to the fact that the ones who wrote, even if the words were true, had access to sources of information concerning the authorship and date of those psalms, which have long since perished, and which modern scholars say do not have, that we should pay very careful attention to. You see his point? And that, I think, is worth considering. Now, he's not saying they're inspired, but he's saying that they are of historical value. Now, J.J. Stuart Perot takes the same approach in his book. In his book entitled The Book of Psalms, he has a conclusion. And this is what he says in the conclusion. He says the inscriptions, that is the psalm titles, cannot always be reliable. You can't always trust them to be accurate, he says. They are sometimes genuine and really represent the most ancient tradition. He says, there's no question when you look at those psalm titles that sometimes they are genuine and they represent very accurately the most ancient tradition concerning the matters of authorship and dating of those psalms. He says, sometimes that's true. That means that sometimes those psalm titles are accurate. But he says, at other times, they are due to the caprice or the whims of later editors and collectors. He says, sometimes the psalm titles are just the whims of later editors and collectors, the fruits of conjecture, people just speculate about the authorship and date of the psalm, and are based on a dimmer and more uncertain tradition. And if the tradition is not as certain as dim tradition, then he says you can't be sure that that psalm title is accurate. And so he says, in short, the inscriptions of the psalms are like the subscriptions to the epistles of the New Testament. They are not, now listen carefully, they are not of any necessary authority. Now when he says that, what is he doing? He's denying the inspiration of the psalm title. They are not of any necessary authority, and their value must be weighed and tested by the usual critical processes. And so what he is saying is simply this, that the psalm titles do have some historical value. They are not inspired. They are not authoritative. They do have some historical value. What we have to do is to apply the best critical processes we have to them to determine which one of those psalm titles represent accurately ancient tradition and which ones are just myth, the editor, conjecture, and ones that are not based on a certain tradition. Now, there is another group that takes this view that they are of historical value, but not inspired, and that is the translators of the Good News Bible, today's English version. Now, it's very interesting to watch what they do with the psalm title. Now, I gave you an illustration of Psalm 56. Now, here is a version, and as you know, many people use this version today. Today's English version is the New Bible, the New Testament translated first in 1966, the Old Testament second, 1976. But then, when you come down, for example, to the Psalm title, you will find that in the version itself, the psalm titles are not put into text. Everyone is eliminated. As far as they are concerned, they are not part of the Hebrew text. They do not consider them authoritative. So, like if you look at Psalm 56, if you look at your Hebrew Bible, you'll find that it won't start the way this particular psalm starts. You'll find a psalm title there as verse 1 in the Hebrew text, and then you come down to the psalm itself. Now, what they do is to prayer of trust in God.
Now, that's not found anywhere. That's something that they made up.
Then they've got a little pee by that. And then it says Hebrew title. Now, if you look at your Hebrew Bible, you'll notice something very interesting. Now, here is the Hebrew title that they put in the footnote. A Psalm by David. After the Philistines captured him in Gath. Now notice, a Psalm by David after the Philistines captured him in Gath. Now that's what they are leading the people to believe the Psalm title says. Now you just take your Hebrew Bible and turn over to Psalm 56. Now you watch this very closely. Now you'll notice that verse 2 starts off with what they start off with in the Psalm. But do they put all of the Psalm title in the footnote? Now remember what I read, a Psalm by David, after the Philistines captured him in Gath. Now question, is all the Psalm title there in the footnote, yes or no? Anybody? Is it? The answer is obviously no. Now look, let me translate this for you. To the one who is acting as director. Do you see that? Did you hear that in the footnote? Alright. Set to the dove of the distant terebinths. Did you hear that in the footnote? A miktam, or a psalm, whether it says, by David, a miktam. And then it says, when the Philistines captured him in Gath. Now, what is the oldest thing that you heard in the footnote? A psalm by David, after the Philistines captured him again. That's all you heard. You didn't hear, to the one who is acting as superintendent or director, sent to the governor of the district territory. You didn't hear that at all. All you heard was, by David, a psalm, when the Philistines captured him again. That's all you heard. And so, here is a footnote that leads you to believe that that's all that's in the Psalm title, but it's not all in the Psalm title. The only thing that they put in the footnote was the historical note, and that David was the author of the Psalm. That's all they put in. So, evidently, they must have felt that the historical notice had some value, otherwise they wouldn't have put it in the footnote. But when it came to the musical, how do you think they view that? How do you think? Yeah, no value at all. They just threw it out. See? They looked at that to the one who was acting as superintendent, sent to the dove of the district therapist. They said, that's no value. Just throw it out. Just not put it in. So they eliminated. It's not even in the footnote. Then they said, by David, a psalm, after Philistines captured him again. They said, that's the historical notice. Well, that has some historical value, not inspired. So we'll put that in the footnote. But it's very interesting, and I pointed this out. They translated miktam. Now get this. They translated miktam. You see miktam there? A psalm. Now if you translate the word psalm before, what is the word for psalm? Dismal, remember that? Miktam only occurs 6 times. And meaning thee is very helpful because the meaning is dubious. Nobody knows what it means. And yet here they are translating this word as if it were mizmor that everybody knows, but it's not that at all. It is miktam. Do you all see that? Now, see what they are doing as far as their attitude is concerned. They look at the psalm title. And they say, well, these psalm titles aren't inspired. And so we're not going to put them in the text. They eliminate them from the text. But they say, it seems like at least the historical part has some value. And so they put a footnote there. A footnote is very misleading because in the footnote, as it says here, it says Hebrew title. And what they do is only put part of the Hebrew title in. They don't put it all in, making people think that here is the Hebrew title, but it's only part of the Hebrew title, not all of the Hebrew title. And then when they put it in, they take a Hebrew word, which is very dubious, only occurs 6 times, nobody knows what it means, and try
translates it by the word some, they can appear as though it's Mizmor, but it's not Mizmor at all. And what they are showing is that they think that perhaps the historical notices have some value, otherwise they wouldn't put it in the footnote, but the musical instructions no value at all, and therefore completely eliminated. Steve?
I believe this is the view we've got in a few directions.
What's that?
This letter of the second view of the song, the musical, but that's not required.
Well, hold on. Evidence, then you make your conclusion.
Well, I agree with you already, I think. Yes, everybody. Stayed in class with the song. That was the first time I ever heard that idea. I never even used the song title to think.
Okay, well, look at the evidence. I'll give you the argumentation, and you make up your mind about it. All right, any other questions on this? Yes, Tom.
Can you hold the narrative and not believe the song title there?
Well, let me give you the evidence. See, the question is whether or not. They are in the autographs. And what I want to do is give you the evidence, and then you can make up your mind concerning it. But this brings me to the third attitude, and that is the attitude that they are inspired. And this is the attitude that I am going to recommend to you. But I want you to look at the evidence before you make up your mind about it and see what the evidence is. I'm not the only one who holds this view. I know that I'm in the minority, but Alexander, in his commentary, holds it. Barnes Notes holds it. Derek Kidner, who is writing a lot of the commentary for the Old Testament Tyndale series, he holds it, that they are inspired. That's put out by InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. There are some others that hold it, but a lot of them will reject the psalm title. But what I want you to do now is this. Now, these are the attitudes. Now, you have the attitudes down. The attitude is number one, that they are not inspired, but not only not inspired, but of no historical value. That is what many say. Then the second attitude is they are not inspired, still not inspired, but they are of historical value, and that would be Samson, that would be Perrault, that would be very obviously the today's English version of the New Bible. And then the third attitude is that they are inspired, and obviously if they are inspired, they are of historical value, and value in every way. That is the view that I am going to recommend to you. Now, any questions on the attitude that you have toward the psalm title? Now, the next thing I want to do is to look at the antiquity of psalm titles with you. Now, I want you to understand what we're doing right here. I'm not considering now the psalm titles in the Hebrew text of the book of Psalms. Every psalm title that we are going to look at now are psalm titles that are not in the Hebrew text of the book of Psalms. You with me on that? So keep that in mind. The psalm titles at which we're going to look are not psalm titles in the Hebrew text of the book of Psalms. So we take all the Hebrew titles in the book of Psalms. We're not dealing with them. There are 16 of them. We're not dealing with any of them. The psalm titles with which we are dealing are psalm titles that are not found in the Hebrew text of the book of Psalms. Now, what I want to do is look at psalm titles not found in the Hebrew text of the book of Psalms and trace them back as far as we can go. Now, the first thing we find is that psalm titles were used in the 2nd century B.C. Now, how do we know that? We know that because you have 32 psalms in the Septuagint which have psalm titles which do not have them in the Hebrew text. Now, remember, there were 34 orphan psalms. Now, 32 of those 34 important psalms are given psalm titles in the Septuagint. Only Psalm 22 do not have psalm titles, but all the rest of them have psalm titles. Now, they were put in by the Septuagint translators, and the only thing that I want you to notice here, now these psalm titles that they put in are not inspired, so be sure to keep that in mind. They're not inspired, but they were put in so that every psalm in the Septuagint will have a psalm title except for Psalms 1 and 2. And since the Septuagint translation was made in the 2nd century B.C., we know that that was done at that particular time. And so that gives that to us. Now, we better take a break. And let's get back promptly now to 20 of our coffee, because I want to try to finish this and put this together for you. And we'll just go right on and wrap this up. So let's take a 10-minute break. Be back promptly now to 20 of our coffee. Come on in.
Father, we thank you that we have the chance to study your word. And Lord, we ask that you would continue to work in us and use these original languages. It wouldn't be something that would slip away from us. But we ask, Father, for your blessing on us to understand and specifically just how these songs came to be, what the meaning of them are, Lord, and how we can use them. Your glory. Thank you, Mr. Hardy, and Lord, for your sacrifice and teaching very biblical. We ask you to invite him and set aside his time now to instruct us through the glory of Jesus.
Now that we were looking at the antiquity of psalm titles, we looked at this first point that we have psalm titles in existence in the 2nd century B.C. Now, yes, Tom?
On this first point here, and during the break into the liberty of running up to Mr. Putnam,
yep.
I asked him what he thought of those psalm titles.
Yes.
And he said the strongest argument he felt for the non-inspiration of psalm titles was this point about the Septuagint. He said, in fact, the Septuagint writers or translators, they felt the liberty to add titles. You know, whereas they always did add text. But they did feel liberties to add titles.
Yes.
It's their own choice, but that's an argument for the fact that they didn't consider the psalm titles themselves to be inspired. Because they treated the rest of the text like, you know.
Yes.
You know,
yes. Well, with the exception that you have to remember that the Septuagint was not as carefully done. This is the reason that the Jews considered it one of the two greatest abominations in their history. That and the golden calf. But see, it wasn't as carefully done. The Pentateuch was, but not the rest of it. And they didn't take the care to do that. But I think what we have to do, Tom, is just to look at the evidence. I'll pile it up for you, and then try to determine which way you feel it leans when we finish. Then you'll be able to make your decision. But there will be a number of pieces of evidence that you want to look at. It's true that the Septuagint did put these extra titles in, but we also know that they just were not as careful in translating and in handling the scriptures. They were anxious to get them out. As were the ones who did the Pentateuch. That is a well-known fact. And so we do need to keep that in mind. But let's keep that in mind as we look at the evidence. Now, the second thing I want you to look at is that psalm titles were in existence in the 7th century B.C. Now, I want you to turn to the book of Habakkuk. Now, remember that the book of Habakkuk is a historical book in the sense that... we'll get it there for you. The book of Habakkuk, let's see now, we need to get back here on page 1052. Now, page 1052, I don't know if my pagination is the same as yours or not, but you have it there, the book of Habakkuk. Now, I want you to notice Habakkuk chapter 3 and verse 1.
Now remember, this is right in the book of Habakkuk. Here you have a book with this right in there. Now notice what it says. A prayer belonging to Habakkuk the prophet is offered upon Shigeyona. Now it's very interesting. See that word prayer that occurs in five of the Psalm titles. I've given you the references where that word occurs. There is Kaftalah, a prayer. There you have the Lament of Authorship. Now, Stephen, this would very definitely be authorship here. Habakkuk wrote the book, and this is a book by, rather a psalm by Habakkuk in the book, a prayer belonging to Habakkuk the prophet upon Shigeyona. It's also interesting that Shigeyona, the word itself, appears in one psalm title, that is in Psalm 7 and verse 1. And so here you have a psalm title. Now you have the exact kind of language that you have in the psalm titles in the book of Psalms. You've got the word prayer that occurs five times. You've got the lament of authorship belonging to Habakkuk the prophet as altar. You've got the plural form of Shigeyon. The singular form is found in Psalm 7 verse 1. BDB translates that as being a wild, passionate song with rapid changes of rhythm. But it is found in the psalm. Now also, notice at the end of this, the very last words of the psalm, to the one who is acting as superintendent on my stringed instruments. Now there you have a subscription. The psalm title is a little bit different here as far as the format is concerned. You want to observe that carefully. You have part of the format, or rather you have part of the psalm title at the beginning and part at the end. Now you don't have it that way in the book of Psalms. In the book of Psalms, you have all the psalm title at the beginning. But here, you have part of the psalm title, part of the psalm title at the beginning, and part at the end of the psalm, with the same words that you have in the psalm titles in the book of Psalms. The word prayer is there, the lament of authorship is there, 102 times, Shigeyon is there, Lament of Sayak is found 55 times in the psalm title. But right here, in this book, you have the psalm title. Now, we know that Habakkuk was written. Habakkuk was written in the 7th century B.C. Now, here you have a psalm title put in this psalm that is in the book of Habakkuk. Now, notice this is a psalm. So your psalms are not all limited to the poetical books. You have a psalm right here by Habakkuk, and it's dated for us with a psalm title. And notice where that psalm title is. It's part of this book. And so we want to keep that in mind. Now then, we go a little farther back. The next thing is, the psalm titles were used in the 8th century B.C. Now, look at the book of Isaiah. The book of Isaiah, chapter 38. Book of Isaiah, chapter 38, and look at verse 9. Isaiah, chapter 38, verse 9. And here we have another psalm. Now, this one is going to be by Hezekiah. Now, notice the first word, a miktav. Now, you don't have this word in the psalm title. You have miktav, but not miktav. That simply means the writing. Belonging to Hezekiah, the king of Judah, his author, when he was sick, and he was recovered from his sickness. Now notice what you have in this psalm title. You've got the lament of authorship belonging to Hezekiah, the king of Judah, his author, just like you have in the psalm titles. And you've also got set out the circumstance of the writing of the psalm, just like you do in the psalm titles. You have 13 psalm titles. You're doing one of them, where you have the circumstance of the composition of the Psalms set forth. And here it is. It's set forth when he was sick and he recovered from his sickness. And so you have the clearly. And then you'll notice that at the end of the psalm, you have a hint of a subscription. It says, therefore, we will play by musical instruments all the days of our lives by the house of the Lord. Now, you don't have the subscription stated there as clearly as you do in Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 20. It's only hinted at there, where he says, therefore, we will play my stringed instruments in verse 20, all the days of our life by the house of the Lord. Just a hint of a subscription there, similar to what you have in Habakkuk chapter 3, where it says, the one who was directing all my stringed instruments. There is very clearly a subscription, a musical subscription. Here, it is only hinted at. But you do have a title on this thing. And here is a song by Hezekiah. And notice, it is in the book of Isaiah. And that song title is right there in that book. It is verse 9 of Isaiah chapter 38. And so Isaiah was written in the 8th century B.C. And you know that a psalm title was used then because it's there. You wouldn't have had it there if it hadn't have been used. And so you have psalm titles now going back to the 8th century B.C. We see them used in the 2nd century B.C. We see a psalm title in the book of Habakkuk. Now remember, these are not psalm titles that we have on the Psalms in the Hebrew text. See, all these are different. And you have in the Hebrew text. But you have a psalm title with on a psalm in Habakkuk's time in the 7th century B.C. You have a psalm title on a psalm in Isaiah's time in the 8th century B.C. Now, wouldn't it be great if we had one that would go all the way back to David's time? A psalm that was written by David with a psalm title on it. So that the words made it very clear that both the psalm title and the psalm were written by David. If we had a case like that, that would be very, very, very nice, wouldn't it? It would help to really set it up. All right, now, let's turn to 2 Samuel chapter 23. 2 Samuel chapter 23. And I want you just to look at this in the Hebrew text. We got to get the Samuel here. Here we go. 2 Samuel chapter 23. Now, I'll let you take your English Bible, and I want you to keep your Hebrew Bible open, because there are some words here that you will recognize very clearly. Now, take your English Bible and read me Psalm 23, or rather, 2 Samuel 23 and verse 1.
Now, these are the last words of David.
All right, now, pause right there. Now, these are the last words of David. Now, you would expect, now you see where they're there in the Hebrew Bible, their first argument. All right. Now, what follows then would be the last words of David, isn't that right? Now read those words to me, Tom.
David, the son of Jesse, declares, and the man who was raised on high in the anointed of the God of Jacob, and the sweet psalms of Israel.
All right. And then, what you have is a psalm. Now, what you read, Tom, is the psalm of faith. See? And then, what you have is a psalm. That psalm is not found in the psalm. It goes from verse 2 down through verse 7. Worded. The way this is worded, there's no question that that's indicating that both the psalm title and the psalm were written by David. Now, these are the last words of David. And then you have a psalm title and a psalm. Now, what I want you to see is that you have psalm titles now going right back to David's day. It's very interesting. Now, I want to read this verse to you out of today's English version. Now, listen very carefully as I read this to you. 2 Samuel. Samuel 23. Now listen carefully. Now watch your Hebrew and watch your English. Now here is what the way 2 Samuel 23 one reads in today's English version in the New Bible. David, son of Jesse, was a man whom God made great, whom the God of Jacob chose to be king, and who was the composer of beautiful songs for Israel. These are the last words of David, and then follows the song. Now, did you notice anything any different? What did you notice different?
Just
the three sounds. What's any significance of that?
They reversed the order. The last words of David was put right before Psalm.
That's right. So according to this, David only wrote the psalm, not the psalm title. You see it? Now in the Hebrew, is it worded that way?
Yeah.
No. In the Hebrew, it is very, very clear that David wrote what? Both the psalm and the psalm title. And what the translators here have done, and you can see the Hebrew for yourself, because it's there. Now these are the last words of David. Then the psalm title, then the psalm. What they have done is to switch it around so that the psalm itself is written by David, but not the psalm title.
Yeah, it makes much more sense in this way.
Yes.
There's no reason to do what they did. I mean, this is really logical that you would write that.
Yes, it is. But you see, what they have done is to switch it around. Now, see, one of the criticisms that you get for David not writing the psalm title, so that's in the third person. But now, who does it say wrote that psalm title? It says David wrote it. And in what person is it? It's in the third person, is it not? See, there you have it. And see, right here, now, what, right here, you have evidence that David not only wrote the psalm, but wrote the psalm title. And it's right there in the Hebrew text. And what these folks want to do, see, is get rid of the title so that David won't have the title ascribed to him. And that's why they change it around. And they only have the psalm ascribed to David and not the psalm title. Because they don't consider the psalm titles inspired, and yet, though they don't consider the psalm titles inspired, they put it right there in the text. Now, it's very interesting that here, this is in the text, switched around so that David only wrote the psalm and not the psalm title. And it's very interesting that when you look at the others, they are in the text as well. For example, if you go back to Habakkuk and in chapter 3, they've got that psalm title right here in the text. See? But the psalm titles in the book of Psalms, they completely eliminated them altogether. Isaiah would be here in the text as well. But you see, what they've done is to switch the words around so as to make David only the author of the psalm and not the psalm title. Whereas in the Hebrew, David is very clearly the author of both the psalm and the psalm title. Now, what you have is this. You can take psalm titles, and you can trace them right back through Israel's history. Psalm titles that are not found on the Psalms in the Hebrew text. But you can trace them right back through Israel's history. Second century, Septuagint put them on. Seventh century, Habakkuk used the Psalm title. The eighth century, Isaiah, in Isaiah's time, Hezekiah used the Psalm title when he wrote that particular Psalm that Isaiah put in there. In David's time, you have a psalm written by David with a psalm title written by David. And so what you can do is trace the psalm titles historically right back to David's time. And you have the scripture stating that here is a psalm with a psalm title and that David is the author of both. And so you do have psalm titles in David's day. And if he wrote one psalm, or he was certainly one of others as well. And so you can trace them right on back to that point. Now then, any question on the antiquity of psalm titles? You see what we're doing there? See, I've traced them back, And I want you to keep in mind now, are these psalm titles the psalm titles we have in the Hebrew text and psalms? Yes or no? Come on, sleepy scribe here. Let me get you with it here.
Yeah. No.
No! All right.
Sure.
All right. You can see, are any one, Jack, or any one of these psalm titles that I read that you found in the book of Psalms, in the Hebrew text?
No.
Well, okay. Not in the book of Psalms.
Well, the one James last week.
No, that's in 2 Samuel.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's not in the book of Psalms.
That isn't repeated in Psalms.
No, see, that psalm is not in the psalm. You with me? I keep you all with me here today. All right. You with me now?
Yeah.
All right. So we have psalms, not in the Hebrew text, with psalm titles that we trace right on back to the book of Psalms itself. And to David's day. Now then, we come next to the authority of the psalm title. Now, Jack, here is where I want to try to answer your question. What about the authority of the psalm title? Are the psalm titles inspired? Now, there's no question that we've got psalm titles going back to David's day. We can historically trace them back to David's day and to a psalm title written by David himself. Now then, what about the authority of them? Well, what I want you to notice first is this, that the psalm titles appear in the oldest manuscript of the complete Hebrew Bible that we have that dates back to 1008 or 9 AD. Now, that manuscript is found in Leningrad. Now, what I want you to notice about these psalm titles is this. You translated some of the psalm titles in the book of Psalms, 23, 32, Psalm 3, and some of you translated that right now. But you translated it. You will notice that in the book of Psalms, they are either part of verse 1, or all of verse 1, or verses 1 and 2 in the psalm titles. For example, in Psalm 51, the reason you have a different versification is because the psalm title constitutes the first two verses. And so, when you look at the psalm title in the book of Psalms, you will discover that they are either part or all of verse 1, or verses 1 and 2. When you look at the psalm title in Habakkuk, was it part of that book? Was it part of the manuscript that we have? Absolutely. It is found in that manuscript. Otherwise, it wouldn't be there. It is found in that manuscript. How about the one in Isaiah? Was that found in the manuscript? Yes, it was. Otherwise, it wouldn't be there. How about the one in 2 Samuel chapter 23? Was that found in the manuscript? Yes, it was. And there's another one in 2 Samuel 22. Just read 2 Samuel 22 verse 1 to me. This psalm is very similar to a psalm that you have in the Psalter. Who has 2 Samuel 22, verse 1? Somebody read that for me. Stephen?
NIV. David sang to the Lord the words of this psalm, and the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul.
And then it goes ahead with a psalm. Now, hold your finger there, Stephen, and read me Psalm 18.
For the director of music of David, the servant of the Lord, he sang to the Lord the words of this psalm, and the Lord delivered it from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. He said,
you see any similarity there?
It's identical.
Identical. And almost. The psalms are almost identical. That's one of those psalms that appears to be repeated. But notice, the psalm title is again part of the text. It is right there. Now, when you look at the Hebrew text, you always have the psalm title as part of the text. Every manuscript we have has the psalm title as part of the text. Now, question. When the Masoretes would go over the text and they would find a matter where they felt that a letter in the text should be different, where would they put the different letter? In the text or in the margin? In the margin. They wouldn't dare tamper with that text, would they? They kept that text pure What they wanted to do was to make sure no changes were in the text, so if there was a different letter, they would put it in the margin. Not only that, but they could tell you how many times each letter of the Hebrew alphabet occurred in each book. They could take Genesis and tell you how many times Alice occurred, how many times Lee occurred, how many times Gibel occurred. They could do that for each book, how many times each letter of the alphabet occurred in each book. They could tell you the middle letter of the Pentateuch. They could tell you the middle letter of the Hebrew Bible. Now, why do you suppose they were so picky?
The Word of God.
Yeah. They had reverence for the Word of God. And they wanted to avoid scribal slips so that no error would creep in to the text. That's why they did it. And if they counted up the number of aleph in a book, and they said, wait, we've got one, two, and three. Somebody made a mistake. They were trying to guard the text very carefully.
It had taken them years.
It did. It did.
Like generations.
They didn't have TV, though.
They counted. They counted every single thing. And this material comes from F.F. Bruce. They counted every single thing that could be counted. Now here's my point. See, in light of that, please tell me how the Psalm titles ever got in the manuscripts when they did something like that, if they were not part of those manuscripts.
They got together, put them in, and added the additional elements, and said, okay, this is the
Lord, Jack.
A freak of nature.
Yeah. With anybody so careful that they wouldn't allow anything to get into that text, how would this ever get into the text? The evidence, as far as the manuscript, and this is the oldest complete manuscript we have, but I'm not through yet. I'm going to pause some more up for it. The evidence shows that they're all part of the text. Now, what are they going to do? Count all the letters in Habakkuk and then say, well, here's the Psalm title. We'll just slip that in and we'll ignore that. No, they wouldn't dare tamper with the text that way. Any letter they wanted to correct, they put in the margin. But yet, here are parts of the text. You can see that all of these are parts of the text. Now, when you look at the oldest complete manuscript we have of the Old Testament, the Psalm titles are all part of it. And I think that's one thing we need to keep in mind. The fact is, that is there. Now, let's look at some more evidence, because I want to be sure to get this in. Psalm titles were not only in the oldest complete manuscript of the Old Testament we have. Stephen?
Just a short question. Did the Masoretic put the versification in the Masoretic?
That wasn't done until about 900 AD, Stephen. And yes, the Masoretes did put the verses in, but that was done at a much later time when they settled on the system of vowel pointing that they wanted to use. Now, you have to remember that in the earlier manuscripts, there were no vowel points. See, the vowel points weren't put in until about 900 BD, and that's when the versification was put in. Strangely enough, the chapter divisions were put in a little bit later, but the versification were put in at that time. Yes, the vowel points. The vowel points and the verses. The versification. They put it in at that point, according to that. Now that the Psalm titles appear in a Psalm scroll from page 11 at Qumran, which dates back to the first half of the first century AD. Now, this is a very interesting Dipsy scroll. James Sanders has a book, it's up in the library, there's several volumes to this, called Discovery in the Judean Desert of Jordan. And in volume 4, he has transcripts of these Psalm scrolls, or the Psalms that were found in this Psalm scroll. I should say that the transcripts. transcripts of the Psalms found in this Psalm scroll. And it's very interesting that all of these Psalms that are found in this Psalm scroll from the first half of the first century A.D. all come from the latter part of the book of Psalms. And that is kind of providential because of what I'm going to mention next. But here you have now the first half of the first century A.D., and you have Psalms from the latter third of the book of Psalms. Now, as I indicated here, you have 13 Psalms with Psalm titles. 13 Psalms with Psalm titles. Those same Psalms have Psalm titles in the Hebrew text. The very Psalms that have Psalm titles there in this Dead Sea Scroll have Psalm titles in the Hebrew text. Only three of them are slightly different. 102, 121, 123. I'm going to show you this in a moment. Four more have spaces for Psalm titles, as I will illustrate to you. And if you take the words in the Hebrew text, they will just fit those spaces. That means that you have four Psalms in addition to the 13 that have spaces for Psalm titles. But the Psalm titles are not written there. But if you take the Psalm titles in the Hebrew text and put them in, it'll just fit those spaces.
Are they blank or are they
missing? Hold on, I'm going to show you the whole. I've got a copy of this transcript I'm going to show you. But that's what I want you to keep in mind. And then of the 13 of these Psalms that have Psalm titles, five have spaces where words are missing in the Psalm title. But the words in the Psalm titles of these Psalms in the Hebrew text fit those spaces. Now, with that in mind, before I go any farther, because it's easier to see this and to understand it, let me just show you how this works. Now, take your Hebrew Bible. Look at Psalm 121. Now, you get Psalm 121. You see that already up there? All right, just move up if you can't see it. Now, I'll point to where I want you to see. The top part's a little bit brighter. I couldn't get this any brighter over here. But look at Psalm 121. Now, you see where I'm pointing right there? Now, there is Psalm 121. Now, there is your Psalm title. Now, look at your Hebrew text. What does your Hebrew text say? There's only one slight difference there. The first two words are your Psalm title. You see the word shear? That means psalm. Alright? You see the word hamatalot? See it right there?
Yes.
Alright? Now, literally, that would be the Psalm of the Ascent. Now, in your Hebrew Bible, you have a lamed where that A is. Is that right? Alright? Now, that's the only difference. A Psalm of the Ascent. And you'll notice that the Psalm title, now watch this, the Psalm title is on the same line here as beginning the psalm. I will lift up my eyes unto the hills. See it? Now, is that psalm title part of that text or not? It's right there, isn't it? And it's part of the text, even on the same line. Now, look at Psalm 122. There is Psalm 122. Can you see it? Now, look at the psalm title in your Hebrew text. It says, the Psalm of the Ascents. Is that what your Hebrew Bible says? Alright. Now, what is the next word in the Hebrew Bible that they just look there? Alright. Lavi, belonging to David as author. Now, here, there it is. Lavi, belonging to David as author. You see it right there? Then you have Sheen. What is the first letter of the word that starts? You see the sheen? Now you see part of that is missing, Tom, of the text itself. But notice again where this occurs. You see where that psalm title is? Is that considered by them to be part of this psalm? Very definitely.
Did you say that this manuscript is just blank after it or is disintegrated?
Oh, the words weren't there. So it kind of disintegrated, I guess would be a good word.
Like the paper itself?
Yes.
Wasn't there?
Yes.
Like somebody cut it out.
That's right. In other words, they're copying off
the letters that they had. In other words, the letters would not show where these blank spots are.
Okay.
All right. Now look at 123. Now, 123, what is the first word of your psalm title?
Sheer.
Sheer. Now, what is the next word? What is it? I'm at the low. Now, notice, sheer. Now, you see that spot right there? Wouldn't sheer fit in there very nicely? Right there?
Yeah, but come on, look.
No. Now, this is one where they did have an extra word, Tom. You don't have Dawid in your Hebrew Bible there, do you?
No.
Now, see, that word was put in extra. And the only other thing that's different, here's Hamathalot right there. You see it? Now, what do you have? A hay, the article instead of a line?
Yes.
But, you see, they are the only differences. Now, remember I mentioned that there are only three that have slight differences. One was 121, one was 123. But all the rest of them, of the 13, are going to be the same. Now look at 126. Look at your Hebrew Bible. Look at the Psalm title. Here you see Sheer Hamathalot. What does your Hebrew Bible say?
Sheer.
There it is. Is it part of the text? There it is, right there. See, just like you have in the Hebrew Bible. Let's see. Let's look at 127. Now, 127 has a little part missing. 127 is by Solomon. What is the first part of 127?
Sheer Hamathalot.
All right. Now, it's Sheer Hamathalot. And then it says, belonging to Solomon as author. Isn't that right? Now there is belonging to Solomon as author. Do you see that? Now look at that space. Sheer Hamathalot can fit in there very nicely. See? Sheer Hamathalot. Look at 125. 125. What is the first word? Here's 125 right up here. What are the first words of 125? Sheer Hamathalot. See how I can go right in that space. Now you see what I mean about the spaces. Now, see, you have 13 psalms in this psalm scroll that have psalm titles. The same ones have psalm titles in the book of Psalms. Three of them are only slightly different. I showed you two of the three. 121 had the lamed instead of the hay. 123 had Laman, Kahay instead of a Laman, and had the word Dawid in there. That was all. And the other one I mentioned, what was it, 102, that was slightly different. But the rest of them are all the same. Four of them, say, have spaces for the psalm title, in addition to those 13. Four of them have spaces for the psalm title. But the words in the Hebrew text, like I showed you, can just fit in those spaces. And then of the 13 that have psalm titles, some of them have some words missing in the psalm titles. As I mentioned to you, there are five of them there. And it's very interesting that there is only one psalm. There's only one psalm in this psalm scroll that does not have a psalm title. Now remember, it does not have a psalm title that has it in the Hebrew text. And that's Psalm 144. And that only consists of one word. In other words, if you look at the Hebrew text, you'll see a psalm title. If you look at the psalm scroll, you will not see a psalm title for 144. But it only consists of one word, Lamed, belonging to David as author. Now, you can see that the psalm titles here are part of the manuscript that they had. And the way they put them in, they certainly were not considering them as being separate from those manuscripts. They considered them to be part of the manuscript. Now, these were obviously copied. Now, the third thing that is of great interest is this. Now, notice the third thing that I mentioned here. The psalm titles appear
in a manuscript from cave 4 at Qumran, which dates back to the 2nd century B.C. Now, this other one was the first half of the 1st century A.D., and that had the last third of the song. Now, here is a manuscript that dates back to the 2nd century B.C., and it has the first 69 songs in the same order in which they appear in the Hebrew Bible, with the exception that Psalm 32 is missing. And 71, I believe, comes right after 38. But with that exception, they're in the same order that you have in the Hebrew Bible. And not only that, but the same psalms that have psalm titles in the Hebrew Bible have them in this manuscript. Now, this is the first part of the Book of Psalms. See why I said it was part of the nation. You've got the first part of the Book of Psalms. 2nd century B.C., you have psalm titles in that Dead Sea Scroll. You've got the first half of the 1st century A.D., the latest third, you've got psalm titles in the Dead Sea Scroll that was found. So all the manuscripts that we're looking at have the psalm titles in them. Then, one last point that I make here, and that is this, that the psalm titles were in existence at the time the Septuagint was made. Now, they had to be in existence, otherwise the Septuagint translator could not have translated them. See?
But we have evidence from the Septuagint that they made some up.
Yes, they did. But the point I'm making here is that the ones that they translated had to be in existence at that time. Otherwise, they couldn't have translated.
Surely they would have realized that the fact that here, look, these titles are in the manuscript.
Yeah.
In the manuscripts. It just seems unbelievable that they would take it upon themselves to add the text.
Well, you see, if it were done by people that weren't as meticulous, by people that weren't as meticulous as the Jews claimed, you could understand that. They just wanted to translate it to get it out as quickly as possible. The Septuagint done more carefully, the Pentateuch. But the other part, that anybody would tell you, it wasn't done as carefully. That's why the Jews hated it. That's why they called it one of the two abominations. The golden calf and the Septuagint, things they needed to look, because it wasn't done as carefully. Yet, it does testify to the Masoretic text being in existence at that time. Now see, the point that I'm making here is that, aside from the ones that they put in, you have those psalm titles translated, which means they had to be in existence. You can't translate something that's not in existence. And not only that, but those psalm titles had to be very old. Now, why did they have to be very old?
Because
they didn't understand any of them. And so what you have to do is to allow time for those psalm titles in the Masoretic text from which the Septuagint was translated to lose some of their meaning, so that those musical terms would not be as well understood by the translators, so that they would mistranslate some, and to allow enough time so that some of those words, like mahalath, would not be understood, so that they would transliterate it, which means you're pushing the psalm titles back a good while prior to the 2nd century B.C. Now, when you take all of that evidence, you've got psalm titles appearing in the oldest complete manuscript of the Hebrew Bible that we have. A manuscript that was guarded by the Jews, so that they counted how many times each letter appeared in each book. That was safeguarded by them so that they wouldn't write any letters in the text itself, but put the letters in the book. You have psalm titles in that book, not only in the Book of Psalms, but in Habakkuk, in Isaiah, in 2 Samuel chapter 23, and 2 Samuel chapter 22. It's part and parcel of that manuscript. When you look at the David. It has the psalm title, and very definitely those psalm titles were part of the text. When you look at the 2nd century B.C. at the Dead Sea Scroll there, the psalm titles are part of the text. The same psalms that have psalm titles have the psalm titles in that Dead Sea Scroll. They were in existence when the Septuagint was translated. Otherwise, they couldn't have translated them. And long before that, because you have to allow time for the meaning of some of those words to become unknown. Now, to me, when I look at evidence like that, to me, I can only draw the one conclusion. And that conclusion is that in all probability, those psalm titles were in the Ark. We've got evidence that David wrote psalm. We've got it going right back to his day. And my conclusion would be, on the basis of that evidence, is that in all probability, I don't have the autograph, so I can't say here's the autograph, there's the psalm title. But the evidence points to it being in the psalm title. And my own feeling is you have to throw away an awful lot of evidence if you're going to say they're not in the psalm title. Jack? Oh, you're thinking about the exam. And here I thought he had a good question about the psalm title. Okay, Stephen.
Then, in a sense, even though we can't prove, let's say, that they were in the autographs, we can't. There's no evidence to the contrary. There's no reason to assume that they weren't there because there's really no evidence.
Well, you've seen the evidence. All the evidence, everything we have, has the psalm titles. And when I see it in the text, and my feeling is this: when you see them in the text. Now, not to say they're not problems. I haven't finished the discussion yet. And there are some problems, but it doesn't mean they're not answers. When you see them in the text, now, if you're going to say, well, I'm just going to cut off this part of the Hebrew text, upon what principle do you do that? You know how meticulous the Jews were. Now, am I going to say, well, I'm going to cut verse 3:1, verse 19 out of Habakkuk. I'm going to cut off 2 Samuel 23:1, 2 Samuel 22:1, Isaiah 38:9, all the others. See, not even today's English version cut them out. Now, why is it that they put them in and left the others out?
Why, in light of this evidence, why is there human language? And not, I mean, that's not even talking about.
Well, you know, I doubt. That everybody has all this evidence. I haven't seen it. When you read it, I don't see all this evidence. But here it is. I mean, it's there. Miller Burns was the one that mentioned the Dead Sea Scroll from Psalm 2. I mean, from Psalm 1-69. And his book, More Light on the Dead Sea Scroll. He's recognized everywhere. And what you have is evidence like this that I feel makes us go with the conclusion that the psalm titles are inspired. But what you need to do is look at it. It seems to me, we'll take manuscripts and we'll say, now, all the evidence points that this part of the text wasn't in the autograph. Now, we can't be dogmatic. But we'll say the evidence is there. So we don't build doctrine on it. We say we want to understand it just in case it was, but the evidence would suggest that probably it wasn't. Now, when you look at this, you have a lot of evidence, a whole lot. Every manuscript we have has the psalm title. I don't know of anywhere they're cut off. And so what are we going to do? Are we going to say, well, I'm just going to throw away? See, that's what I think. You've got to throw away an awful lot of evidence. If you do not believe the psalm titles, or to put it this way, if you do not believe there's a strong probability of those psalm titles being in the autograph. Now, as I said, I don't have the autograph, so I can't say, see the autograph, see the psalm title. But it is preserved in the text. They're right there. They're part of the Hebrew text. And if we're going to cut off part of the Hebrew text, where do you stop?
There's other places that come to mind, too, that we haven't brought up, like Song of Moses and
find that. There's lots of poetic sections in the Old Testament
that
have inscriptions of the people wrote this and so forth, which could be
arbitrarily. And they're not, those particular ones, Stephen, are not set up as a song title like these are. See, these are very obviously the song titles. And see, the one that I gave you had inside the Book of Psalms. See, it had the same information that the ones in the Book of Psalms have. See, the same type of information is there. That's what makes it so fascinating. And now, why are these so important? Well, see, when it says, to the one who is acting as superintendent or choir director, well, we saw the arrangement that they had. So what would happen? Well, the psalmist would be given to the one who's leading the choir at that particular time. And those musical instructions are there so that they will be able to sing those psalms with the musical accompaniment just the way David wanted the song. That's why they're there. See? I mean, it's just not words that have no meaning. Nobody's going to write nonsense and put them on a song. See, they made perfect sense when they were first written. And they are musical instructions in part, or part of the historical instructions, but part of the musical instructions to the choir director as to how to have this song sung.